We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate, and five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. We're hoping that your meditation practice is giving you just what you need to stay more calm, grounded, and resilient this winter, wherever you are. Check out choosemuse.com for some great deals right now on your Muse headband. In February each year, we like to encore some of our favorite relationship episodes. Today's encore is with Daphne Rose Kingma. Daphne's a best-selling author of 12 books on love and relationships. She answers some tough questions on why relationships can be so challenging and shares why expecting others to read our minds is not a good idea. She shares her juicy wisdom on navigating relationships, learning to love, and how to be a better partner. And there's more. Now, here's Daphne.
Daphne, it is such a pleasure to have you on Untangle today. I'm really excited.
Thank you. Likewise, Patricia. I'm smiling with anticipation and delight.
Yeah, my biggest questions in life are about love and relationships. So I am going to ask you a bunch of questions because you have this very unique expertise. And then I have a number of questions from our listeners. So we'll get into that as well.
Wonderful.
Oh, I want to just start by understanding a little bit about how you came to be so interested in love and relationships. Where did it all start for you?
It has been a surprising path, but I think the origin of it for me was that I was the youngest child in a family with five children, and so I had many opportunities to observe the relationships at the family table. And I just remember as a child being so fascinated by all these people who were related to me, their conversations, who interrupted whom, who was trying to get rid of their vegetables on the other person's plate, and the peacemakers, the quiet ones. So I just remember very, very early on being so fascinated by the connections between people and the beauty of it and the challenge of it. And that just continued from my earliest days as growing up and seeing romantic relationships unfold and being a part of them and observing them. So I've just always been a passionate observer of human connection.
Yeah, and you've done a ton of research. I think you've written something like 12 books, is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us some of the biggest questions that you've heard over the years from your readers and your clients and patients, and just really curious about that.
I think the greatest question slash complaint that I hear is, why cannot the person who loves me understand my needs? Why is there this gravelly road from my needs to getting them fulfilled by the person who loves me? And I think that that's because we tend to have an underlying assumption that love will make wizards out of us, and that the energy of love itself will make us suddenly smart enough to figure out what another person needs and how to deliver it to them. So that's a huge one. And I think another very big one, especially from women, is why can men not contact their feelings? Why, I ask him how he feels, why can't he tell me, what's the big deal? And to realize the difference in the emotional structure or the emotional history and journey between men and women, which creates a lot of challenges in soothing and sustaining relationships, knowing about those differences and knowing how to traverse them. And I think a very simple and awful one question is, why do relationships end? Why do we get to this place sometimes or often with someone that we love deeply or have loved deeply, that there's no future territory to transverse and to undertake with that person? And of course, there are a lot of reasons for that. They all make very interesting sense. But I think the mythologies that we have about love in our hearts often give rise to these questions. Those, I think, are the biggest things that I've found myself dealing with people. There are thousands of sub-questions, but those are the really big operators in my experience.
And it's so interesting. I mean, those are a lot of the questions that I had written down and that some of our listeners have really dovetail into those. And my next question was, why are relationships so complicated and why do we all feel so romantically challenged? If you think about what you just said in terms of understanding the needs of your partner, like how are we supposed to be mind readers? And then this idea right. of men not being as connected to their own personal feelings, it starts to feel like, yeah, it's obvious. You almost wonder how relationships ever make it with those kinds
of
questions looming. So let's get into a little bit of detail. Like, how do we begin to understand the needs of our partner? Or is that even necessary? Do we first need to dissolve the myths of the perfection of a relationship and just know that our needs maybe can't be met by the other partner?
It's very paradoxical. I mean, that's always a good umbrella to start operating under, because human relationships, love relationships, romantic relationships, where we have all these dazzling hopes, are two things at the same time. They're an experience, and they're launched by a very profound experience of the energy of love, which is a spiritual energy, as we know, and that holds us in life and that shines the sun and does all these things that are beyond and within us. So we're drawn into this human experience of relationship by this profound spiritual energy. And that's what we mean when we say falling in love. We mean that we've had some kind of momentary or longer than momentary transcendent experience with another person. And that then launches us into this experience that we call a relationship. And when we enter into that experience that we call a relationship, we start engaging with the personality of another person. And that's a very different kettle of fish.
So spiritual energy versus personality.
Personality energy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. And is that what becomes complicated, because our personalities are so complex?
Yes, exactly. Because the transcendence and the beauty and the mystery and the majesty of the falling in love experience, which we've all had and which is just gorgeous and glorious and fabulous and
the best.
You know, the best. Yes. but it takes us into this territory where we're really engaging with another person's personality. And of course, the task of really coming to know one's own personality and the complexity of it and the tragedy of it and the beauty of it and the sensitivity of it and the power of it is such an incredible work in itself. And then you take another person who is also a personality with all those components operative all the time. And there's a tremendous amount to learn in regard to that first thing that I said about what's the question that people most ask. It's like, we want them to be mind readers, but it's such a big deal to get to know who you are as a person that we just imagine that the other person will somehow have a similar life experience. We generalize on the basis of ourselves.
Yes.
Because that's the most we know, you know, we've figured out some things about ourselves. So I like dogs. The person I love will like dogs. I like to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and meditate. So the person I love will. It's like we're operating from a set of assumptions that are based on our own reality. And that experience, that stretch of coming to know another person in their differences, in their uniqueness, is just really a big challenging deal. It's an incredible journey. It's a mystery and an adventure and a task.
Well, it almost makes me wonder if for those of us who are highly curious and wired to ask a lot of questions and maybe a little bit more complex, relationships could be a little bit more difficult than people who are, I don't want to say simpler, but maybe it is true. There are certain people that accept things just as they are without being so complicated. Do you see a difference? Because it's almost like, how then do you overcome these giant hurdles of knowing someone? What is that wisdom that it takes?
Well, it takes wisdom and grace and forgiveness. And to go back to the first half of your question. Yes, I think it's kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, I think that operates too in the creation of relationships that, and without, as you said, making it a derogatory statement, but I think some people's needs in relationship are much simpler. Is there somebody to plow the back 40 while I'm canning the tomatoes? Or is there somebody to watch football while I'm washing the dishes? These are very hackneyed examples, of course, for our complex modern world. But I think the more self-examined and the more gifted, let us say, the more a person is involved with their own commitment to offering their soul's gifts, which is another whole huge area, then life becomes more complicated because you're not just saying, well, can I fall in love with somebody and do we eat the same dinner? But you're saying, how can I, with my awareness of my unique talents and my commitment to offer that, make a space for that in this arena that we call a relationship? So it does get more complicated and it does get more difficult, and it requires people of similar awareness or similar willingness to awareness to navigate that. I'm going to go off on a little teeny bit of a tangent here. I think one of the most beautiful things about relationships is that we enter them with a different repertoire. And so the great healing and gorgeous, exciting possibility of them is that one person can take the other person on a journey to experiences and awarenesses and healings and growth that they would never arrive at without joining up with that very different person who's developed in another way. And so that's the beauty part of it. There's a lot to be received from the differences. And of course, there needs to be some kind of a nice kind of dovetailing of what is being offered too. And I see that so beautifully so many times, people who are engaging with one another, and that the person who shows up has exactly the kinds of experiences and gifts and interests and viewpoints that enlarge the other person in exactly the way that they have needed to keep evolving as a self. So that's fabulous. But it as you say, it requires interest and willingness and flexibility and gratitude, really, you know, to say, wow, this person has shown up with something that my life has been longing to receive, and I'm in a state of gratitude about that.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
And does that state last? Or let me put that in a different way. What does it take to sustain a good relationship over time? And how much work do you think it should take? And what does work really mean?
Oh my goodness. We have 1,000 hours.
I know. You're going to want to read your books after this for sure. All the answers are in there.
That's a lot of questions. But I want to say, Patricia, that every one of them is so important. Let's just pause there and let me acknowledge that, because these are the things that are so baffling and confusing and difficult to people. And I guess I'll just kind of lay out some broad strokes, which is, yes, we have these experiences in which things are being offered and received and exchanged. And sometimes people are very aware of it. I can speak in my own life of coming to certain junctures in my life and thinking, wow, what I really need is a person who is aware of this or has this gift, and having that person show up and just going on a remarkable experience of having my life enhanced and just expanded in a profound way. And then sometimes that is a receiving that is completed. And those are the points at which a relationship often organically ends. It's like, okay, I mean, people don't say this. Mm-hmm. We don't say, okay, well, now I've gotten what I needed to get right. from you. So toodaloo, I'm on my way. But the truth is, and I wrote about this in a very easily digestible form in my book, Coming Apart, which of course is about the end of relationships, but that we're all always on a journey of self-evolution. That's what we're doing here on Earth. We're not just here to take up space and watch TV. We're here to advance the development of our souls. And we do that through our personalities, because we are people with personalities and histories and problems and stuff that we want. And so a relationship always comes along to somehow support that evolution. I could say so much about that, and I wish I could actually, but I want to be mindful that we don't have eternity here. We only have time. But anyway, so when people come to a juncture where there's usually, as we know, there's a point or several points in a relationship where people have, quote, worked on it, or they're coming to a place where things don't seem very lively. And then what happens is that the relationship at that point is completed and comes to an end. And of course, that can be very painful. And there's a lot of heartache and a lot of things, a lot of difficult feelings. But usually, or always, actually, if people pause to look at the relationship afterward in an insightful and willing way, there's an awareness of, oh, this is what was going on in that relationship. I was being transformed in a certain way, and my partner was being transformed in a certain way. You often don't see that inside a relationship, by the way. Sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't.
Right.
But it's often afterward, oh, I get it. That's what that was about. That's what we were doing together. And when we finished that doing together, then there was a new lack of energy in the relationship, and that was the beginning of our coming apart. And I'll just use a really, really obvious example is when people get married and they have children, and then the kids grow up and the last one leaves high school, and then they split up. I'm working with several couples right now, of which that's true. And over my many years of work, it's been many, many, because their task together was to create this nurturing environment and raise children. And there were many things that they learned in that process. But when that is over, very often, then the differences start to reveal themselves. Mm. And then that's a very classic point. It's not inevitable, but for many people, that is a point of kind of the train switching over on the tracks.
When you get to that juncture, or any juncture for that matter, what does it mean to work on a relationship versus hitting that juncture and feeling a lack of energy in the relationship or feeling like you're ready
yes.
to move on? Yeah. What do you do?
Yes. That was the other part of your question that I thought was so important. And I have to say, I've always hated that phrase work.
I know
work
a lot of
people. Relationship yeah. just sounds like the salt mines, doesn't it? Let me try to find some sweeter words to talk about it. People come to junctures where it seems like there isn't any more movement in the relationship. And then often at that point, they have some therapy or something from the outside happens. Mm-hmm. Somebody gets a new job or somebody decides to go back to school. But there are moments of growth that involve expansion where both of the people are willing to expand. Mm. And then there are also moments of growth which one person is expanding or one person wants to move in a different direction and the other person doesn't find a way to be a part of that or to find a parallel vehicle for growth and expansion. And that's when that thing about working on a relationship usually comes in. And what is often revealed is like, oh, one person is happy with where they've arrived at and they don't want to, maybe one person wants to sail a boat around the world and the other person says, I don't want to sail a boat around the world. I want to raise rutabagas and I'm going to stay home. You
right.
go do that. So it's like at that point, the working on, and I will use that phrase, working on needs to show a new place of flowering and possibility in the relationship, or that will become the point at which the people go in different directions. I've seen people do just amazing things, and I've seen relationships in which one person had a very, very long affair, and that was revealed, and that became the beginning of a new relationship for the couple. Like, wow, okay, now I've learned all this about you. You haven't been present with me for years, but now we're at a different point. Let me get over my shock and anger, and I'm here to get to know you. I mean, I've actually seen that happen and have amazing things happen as a consequence of that.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And I think that goes to, is the work partly understanding that other person?
Yes. And like understanding what was operating and understanding the reasons why and being able to embrace that with understanding, awareness, compassion. And then, of course, the people need to obviously have something that they're going to create together, whatever that may be. Maybe it's just sitting on the front porch and talking for the rest of their lives, or maybe it's
like a shared vision of some sort.
Yeah, some kind of shared vision of some dramatic undertaking or of just some quiet beingness.
Is love, romantic love, sustainable love in your 20s different from later in life in your 50s, 60s, and so forth? Because when you get married earlier, ostensibly you're creating your life together, your work together, or children together. There's something that's a little more obvious
yes.
in terms of what you're creating. So is it more difficult later in life, do you find?
You mean to create it later in life?
To create a shared vision later in life when it's not about the children.
I think it's very paradoxical, yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more difficult because we're not walking down the college halls and seeing the people who might be our possible partners, but it's less difficult in that we know ourselves more. And so there's an awareness, this wouldn't work, this wouldn't work, this wouldn't work, this wouldn't work. And there's also an awareness of, wow, here's somebody who's really a simpatico spirit. Mm-hmm. And we know more about ourselves later on down the road. And so there's the capacity to choose what fits is more highly developed. The kind of the falling in love in early years has the benefit of not being subjected to years of life experience.
Right.
So it's like it's more dreamy and people are more willing to take the risk. It's like, of course, this is going to work out. Yeah, let's go to the moon together. There's this support in youth of optimism and romantic hope that is very sustaining for young relationships. And then, of course, because all relationships go through these checkpoints of change, then there's the time when there are these seasons of reassessment. And at these points, people either find the way to kind of re-up their contract and do the next part or not. Research has shown that people who have long, long marriages go through very, very difficult things. Inescapably, they go through things like, well, that was really a rough patch and we were ready to throw in the towel. And but that they find that after those experiences, if people are together long enough, that they find the later years of their marriage, they say, are very satisfying. And I think it's because they've weathered the storms and because you learn a lot about yourself and another person over that long period of time. It's not like one way is going to be perfect and the other way isn't. Some people find their real compatible, delicious partnership in their third major relationship or their second major relationship. And others go through a lot of difficulties and then kind of say, wow, we went through all that and now we really are able to enjoy one another.
Yeah, it seems like if you can navigate the transitions, and you really like your partner, because it would seem like love, it seems like that likability factor, like you really have to like that person.
I love it that you said that, because it's like to just get up and be around a person you still enjoy getting up and being around. That's really a big deal.
Hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are four experts in psychology that bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
The other thing I was wondering is the interplay between independence and dependence. For example, today, and a lot of young people think about this, women aren't dependent on men for financial security or for technology or other stereotypical things. Maybe men aren't dependent on women in the same way. So you've got like these independent beings, and there's this interplay between how much do we need to be connected versus separate human beings in relationship.
There is something between people that pulls them toward each other. And that continues to be true, even though women can pay their own electric bill, and even though men can heat up their own dinners. It's like there are these very powerful energies, the energy of love, the energy of sexual passion, the energy of emotion, that we just feel some things about certain people. We feel drawn to them. We feel familiar to them. We feel protective of them. We feel connected to them. These are very powerful things that are not in the psychological range. They're more in the mystical spiritual range, or on the mystical spiritual continuum. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. And so these things, which are not measurable, they're very mysterious, but they're very powerful. And they not only draw us to one another, but they also sustain us in the difficult hours. or not. And so when those beautiful things aren't there, when people's sexual relationships fall apart, or when they never had a powerful, passionate connection, or when they can't communicate their emotions, or when they don't comfort one another, or when they don't feel special feelings toward that other person, like liking or like...
Yeah, like you're on the same team.
Yes, exactly. Those energies have incredible power to draw us to one another. And it's interesting, in this age of galloping technology and soon to be galloping artificial intelligence, it's like one of the things that we need to remember is that in all of this technologically pervade intelligence, these things are still not delivering human emotion. And that is what is unique about human beings. That is the signature of our humanity, is that, by golly, we feel about stuff and we can't help ourselves. We feel intensely. We feel intensely gorgeous feelings, and we feel intensely difficult and devastating and hard to manage feelings. And the nature of our emotional spectrum plays a great part in our romantic and human relationships, not even just romantic relationships, but really we're talking about that now. Our feelings are very powerful in our relationships. A component of relationships is understanding that each of us has suffered. It's like each of us is a suffering human being, and our sufferings are unique. They have the uniqueness of our personality signature and history and everything, but that when we make an expansiveness in our hearts to realize that, that changes the nature of relationship. I think the greatest hallmark is that relationships are our great human endeavor to have an experience of love, and that it does involve difficulty and suffering. But I think the more important thing is that to understand that everybody in every relationship has had a life in which they've suffered, and they deserve our holding awareness of that and our compassion when we become intricately aware of it. It's not like I had a bad time and you had a piece of cake. It's never like that. And yet in relationships, we often tend to operate from that. I went through my hell, but when I look over at your life, looks like it was pretty nifty to me.
Yeah, right.
And that's where a lot of judgment and separation and betrayal and, you know, heartache and stupidity can happen.
Right.
It's like not remembering that each of us has had a very anguishing journey in one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I love when you write about the human experiences, this interesting tension between all of these different experiences that happen to us, whether on the material or the spiritual or the emotional, or even you talk about the mundane world. How do we get into the routine lives together? And our expectations are that we will always be swept away, but that isn't the case.
Right.
So we need transition plans to get from one stage to the next.
Right. To get the socks picked up and the laundry done and the garbage out on the street.
Yes. And not so much fun. No.
Right.
Not so fun.
At all.
I have some questions from our listeners. And this first one's from a 25-year-old young woman. And she says, it's said that love means something different to every person or every couple. For example, I have a friend who waited 3 years to tell her partner that she loved him because "I love you" meant "I will marry you," while someone else said "I love you" to her boyfriend after 2 days of official dating. Here's her question. Are there common threads that you can pull out of these different types of relationship to help people know when they are really in love? And this particular woman is calling herself sort of an over-analyzer. She analyzes things really deeply, and she feels like she has no idea when she's in love or out of it or getting there or what. How do you know when you love someone?
Well,
I know. I love that question. So
that is authentic. That is a wonderfully complex question.
Yes.
And I think the answer to that is simple and complex, maybe, but you know it when you feel it. And one of the things I've said in one of my books is nothing that isn't love or that doesn't feel like love can you talk yourself into saying is love.
You can't force it.
You can't force it. It's like you say, wow, this is really strange and different and amazing, and I've never felt this before. That doesn't mean that the relationship will work out to all your wildest dreams, but it's a feeling experience. And obviously, if one person can say that after two dates, they have had some kind of experience that leads them to that place energetically and emotionally. And if somebody else can say that after 2 years or 5 years or whatever long period of time, it's because it's taken them that long to have that feeling bloom in them. And how long all these things take or what are the components of it really has a lot to do with everybody's childhood. Whether it was safe to feel this kind of feeling, could you just fall into it because your world was safe and you were loved, or were there so many difficult, frightening, unreliable things in your world that it takes a lot of steadiness and the practice of experience for a couple of years before you can feel it? So the real answer to that is when you're in love, you will feel it. It will feel categorically different. Nobody can decide how long that will take for any other person or what are the circumstances of it.
Do you think having loss in your childhood, whether death or divorce, would be a reason for having some of that confusion or I have no idea or might take a little bit longer?
Absolutely, because these experiences and so many of the experiences we have in childhood are with the very people that were assigned in our human experience to love us and to give us this experience of safety and connection and warmth and bathed in wonderful feelings. And of course, that isn't what happens so many times. And so we're raw from that. We're self-protective. That crescendo of the feeling of love. Oh, wow, here's this beautiful feeling. It's different. It's new. I'm taken over by it. Some people are so protected, understandably so protected, that feeling can't arise in them. For some people, it can never arise in them because they've been so wounded and betrayed in various ways. So there are some people for whom that's just way out of the realm of possibility.
Here's another question, which I think is really interesting. Do you think that 100% vulnerability is healthy in a romantic relationship, or is it important to keep certain things about yourself to yourself, even when you're in love?
I use and I like the phrase discretionary vulnerability.
Oh, I love that. And okay.
Yeah. And yes, with those we love, we want to reveal ourselves. We want to show the delicate, tender, urgent, troubled, wounded parts of ourselves. But it's a process. It's kind of a step-by-step process of revealing and then seeing how it lands and seeing if we feel safe and then feeling how that whole process has gone and then taking another risk. And I think the idea that in love we can be vulnerable is definitely true. When we feel loved, when we feel emotionally held by another person, we can take more risks. But it's not just take out your whole vulnerable knapsack and lay it on the table right away and then everything's going to be okay. It's a process of trusting and exposing and feeling and being honest with yourself about how your vulnerability is received. Mm. And I think just there are breakthroughs in that too. Sometimes you have to tell somebody 5 times or 62 times about something, or 162 times about something that's very delicate and vulnerable for you. And then there may be a moment where, oh, now I finally get it. I hear what you're telling me. I hear what you've been telling me all along. And so then that opens the doorway to the next level of exposing vulnerability. But I do think it's really, it's a process of just discretion in revealing yourself, because we also need to make sure we're safe as we walk down these corridors of love and exposure.
Yeah. One of the first challenges you said is, why can't men connect with their feelings? So I think if you're a woman and you're sharing your deepest emotion in the hopes of being more emotionally intimate with a person who can't connect with their own feelings, you might feel a challenge with that.
Yes, more than a challenge. You might feel lonely and hopeless and rejected. And
right. Like, what's the whole point of the whole thing? Exactly.
And I think women feel that a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it is sad but true for various reasons that, and we're seeing so much of that right now, that men are so out of it emotionally. Men are so undeveloped emotionally. I'm saying that descriptively, not judgmentally, that the male role has been such that men could not be, weren't encouraged to be, in some ways still aren't encouraged to have access to their emotional being. It's like the direct antithesis to the male role. And so I wrote a whole book about that called The Men We Never Knew. And I mean, many years ago, but it's still true. And it's probably in some ways more true now than when I wrote the book. But the bottom line is, when a man isn't able to respond, then it becomes an opportunity / necessity to say, well, how does that affect you? That I'm telling you that my mother was an alcoholic and she was sitting in a corner in rags every day when I came home from school.
Yeah.
What does that bring up for you? Mm-hmm. It's like sometimes as women, we have to do, unfortunately, the extra work of seeing, kind of taking a reading on where the man is emotionally. Is he so closed off that he has no feelings or whatsoever? Or is it so scary for him that he can't? So it's sort of like, well, I notice you're not reacting. What does that bring up for you? Or have you experienced anything like that? Or do you wish I hadn't told you? To kind of take a read on where the man is. And I think that the thing between women and men is such a gigantic example of that fallacy that people make, which is assuming that the other person is on the same page developmentally than that they are. It's like, well, I'm telling you this and it really affected me, so I'm sure you're going to get it how it affected me. And I've sat with men in years and years of private work and also in years and years of workshops where women will say some huge, difficult thing and expect the man to know what to say and to say, oh my God, I can't believe you went through that. Come here, let me hold you in my arms. And then inquiring of the man how he really feels and what he should say. And I've had men over and over say, I have no idea what I should say. I don't even know how to process this. I haven't got a clue. And so men are in a very different territory than women are naturally. And we have to, sometimes it isn't worth it to try and negotiate it. Mm-hmm. The guy will say, I don't want to hear about it. Don't tell me. I wish you'd never told me. Or say, I'm speechless, but tell me what you need. How can I help you? Or, I mean, there are various degrees of men, of course. I think of an example, a lovely example of a man who is married and has been for quite a number of years to a woman with a very severe agoraphobia. And when they were getting together, she told him, I mean, this is somebody who can't even drive 5 minutes in a car.
Oh, wow.
And she said, I need to tell you about myself. And this is a condition that I have. And I hope you won't reject me. And he said, I've never heard of that. I hope you will tell me more about it. Do you understand how it happened to you? Or what would you like me to know about that? So that's a very lovely and enlightened man who's saying, okay, I'm willing to go into your world with me. Tell me what I need to know about it so I can be there with you. But many men don't have that capacity. So you have to egg them on, or you have to check them out. Will they go there? Can they handle it? Are they willing, or do they just want to not be present with you for these things?
Yeah, this is such great information. And I think in this situation, women really need to understand what they need so they won't feel frustrated when someone can't meet their needs. And that goes back to one of the other big challenges is understanding the needs of the other person. And with all of this, Daphne, with all of this amazing information and the challenges and the complexities and the difficulties with making commitment over a long period of time, do you still think that marriage has value today? Do you believe in it and that we should make this ultimate commitment?
Well, I'm the renegade person who wrote the book called The Future of Love.
My favorite.
Which really talks about marriage as one of the forms of relationship. I am a true believer in relationship, in our need and our capacity to be related to people we love in many different forms, but particularly in the primary one-on-one relationship, because I think there's so many possibilities for just incredible growth in that relationship. But I think some people will want that relationship to take the form of marriage, and many people won't. And I don't think it's the question of, is it marriage or not? It's like, the question is, do you want to go on the journey of relationship, and in what form would you like to go on it? Mm-hmm. For some people, that still is marriage. And like I was saying earlier, a lot of research of marriages finds that people who are married a long, long time say, wow, it was really an amazing experience. It's like running a marathon. There's something you get out of running all those miles that you don't get out of running the track 20 mm-hmm. minutes at the end of the day. But I think your question is more just a reflection on that relationships are not for sissies. They're not the sort of carefree, you get everything you want kind of trip that has often been sold, and especially in the last century, it's like, have everything you want in your relationship, have the relationship you want, have the job you want and the relationship you want. It's like, you can have everything all the time with anybody.
Yes.
Idea that I think was really sold a lot. So I think people in general are not aware that engaging with another person is a big deal. It's a big, beautiful deal, and it's a big, demanding deal.
Right.
And the rewards are just immense and glorious and surprising and unexpected and bizarre and things that you never imagined were going to happen or become because of being connected with another person. And it's also, you got to really bring yourself to the table.
Right. I love that part. You really do have to bring yourself to the table. I could talk to you forever. You are just so chock full of wisdom, and I'm in awe. I have so many more questions.
Thank you, Patricia.
Come back on our show again. This was so amazing.
I would love that. You know, as you asked me that opening question, I was going to say, and it's a nice time to say it now, just that I never tire of talking about this because I think that falling in love, but any kind of human relationship, is really our greatest spiritual quest mm-hmm. as human beings. It's the place, it's the container in which we can explore our humanness and our spiritual depth. And that's why we never run out of questions about it. We never run out of the need for it. We never run out of the joy in having in it. And it's also the place of some of our greatest anguish in life. So it's just endlessly fascinating and requiring and beautiful. And it's just a total, absolute joy to have this relationship yes. with you where we can talk about it. I feel yeah. very privileged.
Well, I hope our audience will send in more questions and then we'll do this again, because you're right. It is endlessly fascinating. And I am yes. so grateful for you, Daphne. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Patricia. It was a pure joy to be with you.
A big thank you to Daphne for being with us today. You can find her books at Booksellers Everywhere, or her website is DaphneRoseKingma.com, where you can learn more about Daphne and her work. Check it out. If you have feedback, comments, or suggestions, please email us at untangle@choosemuse.com. And if you want to check out Muse, head over to choosemuse.com and use the promo code MUSESTRESSLESS for your discount. Wishing you all a peaceful week. We'll see you next time.